Christmas is all around me, and so the feeling grows.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. It is the holiday season. Love is both in the air and all around us. And that means it's also Christmas rom-com season. And who better to talk about that with me than the great Melissa Sullivan? Mel, how are you doing?
Hello, Dom. To me, your podcasting is perfect.
Well, I'm glad I have something going for me, at least. It does strike me, though, after we were talking a little bit about this off air, that you may not actually be the perfect person to dive deep in the world of Christmas rom-coms with.
This is actually true. I'm guilty. I think I must give off the facade of somebody very well versed in Hallmark. But I'm not. I actually have a very few Christmas movies that are kind of my traditions. And most of them are not the rom-com type. And in fact, and we both, I believe, have seen the same number of times, which is two times now.
Yeah, so Love Actually is something of a tradition for, I would say, British people of a certain generation, where this is the movie that you, when all the family is gathered together for Christmas, that you sit around together and watch. And I remember watching this when it came out for the first time, and I would have been, you know, 10 or 11, which I don't know if that is a good age to watch a movie like this, or if there really is a good age to watch a movie like this. I'm not quite sure who the target audience is meant to be here, but I have a very vague recollection of that, and I actually rewatched it on my birthday last week to prepare for this and get in the holiday spirit for this season, and enjoyed it quite a bit, even though as I age gracefully now, I understand that some bits of it have aged worse than others.
First off, if you're watching this with your family and you are a wee child, we're going to have a problem. And I'm pretty open to it. But there is some real adult content in this that I forget every single time. And yeah, some stuff doesn't hold up, but some stuff really does. And I think that if, you know, if it weren't for the Nokia phones, maybe it would be completely timeless.
There definitely are pointers to a certain time, like, for example, Sam running through the airport with you know, I think that the vibe would be different if you have a small child being gunned down by airport security towards the end of the movie.
Oh, my God. I'm confused because the movie does take place after 9/11. They literally start the movie explaining about 9/11 and using that as a point of reference. So for this entitled child to sneak his way through security, that kid is a domestic terrorist.
And very explicitly, this movie is in a post 9/11 universe as well. And it always is somewhat jarring when you watch a movie from the 80s or the 90s and you see people just going to the gates to bid farewell to their loved ones for one last time. And that's a major plot development, which completely off the table now, unless you're willing to jump through an awful lot of hoops. Somehow here in 2003, young Sam is able to not just bypass the need for airport security, but bypass airport security themselves very nimbly and gracefully as well. Yeah, that kid has athletics in his future.
Truly. I mean, we know that he eventually will go on, nay, 15 years later, to be on Game of Thrones, but actually he's not very athletic on Game of Thrones, so they really didn't use his full ability to, you know, run and dodge and get the airport security to bump into a crowd of people after running through a completely empty airport, which is probably what it looks like now if you go to the airport.
He does also appear as a Benny, the chess passer in The Queen's Gambit, so going from young Joanna to Anya Taylor-Joy, like, this kid is a player. He's a real womanizer.
He is a talent. And I do have to say, the kid is a good actor. He's really tugs on the heartstrings.
Now, I couldn't tell you anything that he's done in that 15, 17-year gap in between. And this is where I rely on you to fill in the gaps there.
I'm going to assume, because I also don't know, that I'd like to think maybe he went to university, he had a life, but maybe still a lingering passion for acting. I could Google it right now, but I think we should just leave our own backstory open.
Mm-hmm. I'm done with that. Just preserve the sense of mystery there. But as you say, the movie does open with this voiceover from the PM, Hugh Grant himself, saying that whenever he gets gloomy about the state of the world, all he needs to do is think about the arrival terminal at Heathrow Airport and just the sheer relief and love on display as people are reunited with their friends and families. And just that idea of being reunited at the airport was very different in a post-9/11 world, and feels quite different as well and quite jarring in 2020 when you would hope that no reunions of any kind are happening at airports.
No, I had to pick my mom up at the airport once, and I picked her up and she had her mask on and she sat in the back seat, and we really kept the distance, you know, between us of like, nope, you know, this is 2020. I'm helping you because you need a ride, but we've got to stay safe here. But I do have an actual uplifting story of the airport, and this is from 2018. I think I'm estimating the math, but my brother picked his then girlfriend up at the airport after she had gone on a vacation, and he proposed at the airport.
Aww.
So very, very Love Actually introduction.
I'm assuming that these are both grown adults and not 6-year-olds chasing each other down through the maze of the terminal.
Correct. They were grown adults. They weren't 17 years old like Keira Knightley in this movie. More on that.
And Keira Knightley at 17, already somewhat accomplished. This isn't like her film debut or anything. This isn't her making her first step on the big stage. And obviously, she would go on to do much bigger and better things as well. But it is worth noting that even though all of these actors and actresses were at much earlier stages in their careers, this is a highly star-studded cast. And I don't know if I think the fact that it is a very light, fluffy Christmas movie makes it more likely that you can enlist a cast like this. But then at the same time, maybe it means that the talents are wasted on something where you're not really meant to turn in a good performance necessarily, even though very many of them do. All you need to do is kind of match the general vibe, and that's good enough.
It really was like a who's who of like known people and then people who became like major players. But yeah, you're right. Some people they're in it, but it's funny because they have like, I guess almost if you were to put like the math together, which I'm sure somebody has done, like they probably have 5 minutes of cumulative screen time in this 2-hour, 14-minute movie.
It's almost like a game to see which A-list Hollywood stars you can get for your minute-long cameo in the background somewhere.
Exactly. I mean, spoiler to jump way to the end, but we even got Denise Richards, you know, A-list American star of 2003. Was she even at that point that high up? Probably not.
Not even sure. I'm working her way up the ladder there. But yeah, you have all of these people like that who you blink and you miss it. You could ask people who just walked out of the movie theater. They might not be able to tell you that person was even in the film to begin with.
The best is when I took notes, I didn't keep character names for the most part. I just called them all the actor names because that's who I'm like, oh, Kira, Chiwetel, Andrew, and I never remember his last name. I always want to call him Andrew Ridgely, which I understand is the guy from Wham. But also you could tie that to Christmas because of the song Last Christmas.
You can tie everything into Christmas, you know, if you try hard enough. All of us and everything is just some number of degrees from Christmas.
Would you say then that Christmas is all around us?
I feel it in my fingers and my toes because it's all part of the same universe, Mel.
So I have to say in Love Actually, and I don't know where other people stand. I don't like, you know, I'm not like on the Love Actually Reddit, which I was assuming must exist, or, you know, deep into the web. And so I don't know what people's favorite storylines are. I know which ones are most viral and controversial opinion. I'm not down with that one. But the Bill Nighy, Billy Mack story, I think actually is my favorite of the movie.
Well, let's get into the structure of the film then, because you have all of these different storylines woven together, some of them quite seamlessly, others with the seams very much visible. And because you have all of these things going on at the same time, no one is an unqualified fan or mostly an unqualified critic of the film. So even if you like the movie in a big picture sense, you like its overall vibe and so on, there are going to be some plot lines which you admit, like, did we really need to work that in there? And then likewise, if you're one of these people writing angry articles about how problematic Love Actually is, you can still find things to enjoy in there. And one storyline in particular, I think we'll agree, is the best in a kind of traditional film criticism sense. But let's get into one of the more unusual, unconventional love stories of the movie, as you say, Mel, Billy Mack and his manager.
Oh, it's a beautiful story. So the other day, I think what it just hit me because I was driving and, you know, like the radio turns to like full Christmas music mid-November. And there was this song on that was like, honestly, the most garbage Christmas song I've ever heard. It was just like people honking, and they set it to the tune of the 12 Days of Christmas. And what I realized is that the bar for Christmas music is really low, and like everybody releases a song because you can get a number one. And that's pretty much what this plot is. So maybe it's also that it personally resonated, but I found it to be just still so funny, just really outlandish. He makes this like egregious promise that if he makes number one, he will sing naked on Christmas Eve on television. Like, it's just so absurd that I enjoy it.
Yeah, but Billy Mack is the cautionary tale for all aspiring rock stars, where, you know, people think they're going to end up as these incredibly famous, successful, popular artists. Honestly, though, the end game for many of them is going to be Billy Mack, and they may not know it yet. That may be 30 years in the future, but they have to start preparing now if they want to avoid it somehow.
He also has the iconic line that I did do some light Googling, of course, to be prepared, that he gets stopped a lot and told the line of don't buy drugs, be a pop star, and he'll get them for free.
Which, hey, it's a refreshing change of pace from saying no to drugs.
That's true. It's just such a ridiculous storyline. Him and his manager in this bizarre relationship of knowing that it's trash, but just trying to get to the top. And I also, you're a British fella. I had no idea until a few years ago, either from this movie or maybe from watching X Factor UK, about how big the number one Christmas song is over there.
Oh, it is a whole thing, yeah. And it's weird, because if you take it too seriously, then it's very much not in the spirit of Christmas. But people do care about being the Christmas number one. That is a thing which will garner attention. And if you're maybe an up-and-coming pop star and not a washed-up pop star, then that's, you know, maybe that's a thing you want to chase.
It's fascinating to me. I feel like we don't have anything that exciting in the U.S., or if we do, I have never been tuned into it. But I've learned to love Christmas music for this one song.
So we've established that you're not a Christmas movie fan in general. Are you a Christmas music fan? Are you how do you feel about the general ambience of Christmas?
So I've ebbed and flowed through life. I did go through a phase probably around when this movie originally came out, where I was like such a Scrooge, and it was like I put my tree up a week before. But now I've really embraced it. I do watch Christmas movies. I just happen to watch maybe the weirder, more obscure ones. So my Christmas tradition, I must always watch Gremlins now. I'm obsessed with Gremlins. I finally saw Die Hard, which I do agree is a Christmas movie. And I have one that I recommend. And then when people watch, they get upset because it's very dark and weird. But I'm giving a deep cut for everybody to find. It's called Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale or A Christmas Story. And it's a very weird movie. It's set like in Scandinavia. It's subtitled. Basically, like, they unearth what they think is Santa, but also could be like a demon. It's fantastic. And it has like a really fun ending, but I can't go too far into it.
Leave that one under the curtain for people who might want to check that one out. But I do both ironically and unironically love Christmas. I'm all about it. All of the schlock associated with it, I'm all in on. What I don't really appreciate is the mission creep, where in late October you walk into any kind of big retail outlet and they're going to be playing Christmas music over their airwaves. What I would prefer is keep it very tightly confined to maybe a 2 or 3 week period, and then for that time just go all out, just blanket the entire nation with Christmas themed paraphernalia, music, whatever, yeah, whatever you have.
Agreed.
And really commit to the bit.
I will say that I know people, there's a certain season that people love. What they'll say is a basic gal might like, was just pumpkin spice season. But for me, gingerbread is my season. I love gingerbread, and I will start dipping my toes into the holiday very early in like a mid-November for gingerbread.
Is gingerbread a specifically Christmas thing, or is it more of just a general like wintry food?
So I consider it Christmas. I don't know how others view it, but I think of it as like a Christmas treat. I feel like after, you know, the 25th, it's kind of weird. You can do, I think, like a peppermint mocha is a winter. Like, I think it started Christmas, but could be longer. But for me, gingerbread, I feel like I'm going to cut it off in about 3 days.
As someone whose peppermint mocha consumption is single-handedly keeping Starbucks in business over COVID, to me that is somewhat timeless, but I could see tying that one to Christmas for sure. But Billy Mack and Joe, did you get any kind of homoerotic undertones to this? Because this is one of the ongoing debates that still after 17 years rages about Love Actually is this meant to be a story of like actual romantic love, or is it the kind of platonic affection and professional admiration that even the kind of grizzled old Scrooge and Billy Mack can finally learn to show during the holiday season?
I did not see that, nor did I know was that a thing. I just thought it was like the weird friendship of like being long-term business partners that like, since there's so many types of love, oh my God, now I'm going to rewatch it a third time and really have to like just skip all the other stuff I really don't like and really just focus on my Billy Mack.
I may have stumbled across some dark corner of the internet here where I guess literally any male pairing in mainstream media is going to have people shipping it on the internet somewhere.
That's so, true. That is
I
true.
Guess we are testing the limits of that philosophy here, but I feel like the show leaves it somewhat open at least.
I mean, why not? I mean, we know that at the end of the movie, Billy Mack brings back a beautiful lady that we know it's not going to work out, you know, but his manager is always there for him.
Yeah, you know, Joe is the one constant in Billy Mack's life, the one person who shows him undying love and support, and not just because that's his job and he's paid to.
Yeah, that's better than most people in this movie who are all stuck together.
Well, speaking of which, let's explore some of those other plot lines then, because, and there are so many of them. I think we have, depending on your count, maybe 9 fully fledged love stories here. And initially, if you delve into the backstory of Love Actually, Richard Curtis was intending to make 2 separate movies. So he had 2 of these ideas floating around in his head and then was thinking about, is there a good way to merge these together? And each of those had a few different strands that were all meant to be tied together neatly, all those loose ends cut off at the very end. And then he was basically forced to get the movie ready under a severe time crunch for the 2003 Christmas period. And so as a result, there were more than a dozen storylines that had been conceptualized. And then I think that there were 2 of them that were filmed that actually didn't make the final cut. And then the ones that we do see, obviously some of them have more detail to them than others. And then there are some which you really could not imagine the movie without. And then there are others which, frankly, you could and do want to imagine the movie without. And if you do, then maybe it becomes a better movie on balance.
And 14 minutes shorter. Guys, I just need to stress that I am a person that believes that all movies should be 2 hours or less. And really, when something is 90 minutes, my heart skips a beat of joy. And I feel like that there are clearly, there's definitely one story that could be cut and nobody would be upset. And I think that there's a second I would cut that I think maybe some would be upset.
Well, let's get into those then. Name your picks.
Okay, I think we all know what's going to get cut. I feel like we could say it at the same time. That's Colin. And I'm sorry, please, like, here's what I realize when I say all this stuff. This is all going to be ripped as sound bites for a future soundboard of me saying, I hate Colin. Colin is the worst. And I know that this is going to be a problem. Guys, I mean Colin, the horny caterer who goes to the U.S., not the podcaster.
I'm going to find a way to make you say stone and shoehorn that word in there later so I can just, like, Franken-splice them together to get the desired effect for my eventual soundboard. But I maybe have more tolerance for the Colin storyline than you do, because it doesn't take itself all that seriously and it's clearly meant to be so over the top that it's kind of a nice diversion in that sense from what actually in some cases are more weighty storylines, and even some of the ones that have a lighthearted energy to them, they still are trying to make this good acting with convincing performers and good chemistry between them. That clearly is not the case with Colin and his American harem. And so I like that they kind of lean into the absurdity of that. And then also, whether or not they admit it, this is the wish fulfillment fantasy for an entire generation of horny young British teenage males. So I feel like it does serve some kind of fan service purpose there as well.
I guess, I mean, I will say the second time watching it, I didn't hate it as much as the first time. That said, it's just like everything is so seated in like realism to an extent. I mean, borderline realism, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it was so outlandish. But I did this time pay attention to who were the actresses. And I was really excited. And I didn't remember that it was a baby January Jones or Alicia Cuthbert or Shannon Elizabeth, who also I think this is probably the last thing she did until she did Celebrity Big Brother,
which was 20
years later.
Really?
I feel like she didn't do much in between. No offense, Shannon Elizabeth. You were okay on Big Brother.
being somewhat distant myself from the whole TV and film stardom, at least for a while, I assumed that Shannon Elizabeth had just steady work going on, maybe in some like B-list roles that I just wasn't aware of, because why would I be? But if it really is the case that she had been off the grid for like 20 years and then they somehow unearthed her for Celebrity Big Brother, then that makes that all the more amazing in my eyes.
I have to guess that she was in all these holiday Christmas movies that you thought I watched, but I didn't watch. And that's what she's been like living off of for, you know, 15 years of work.
I'm scanning her filmography here, and that does basically seem to be the case. So
she was like the it girl, and then, you know, kind of like everything in Hollywood, it's suddenly there's a new flavor on the scene.
Yeah, I'm looking down here. We've got Catch a Christmas Star in 2013, Marshall the Miracle Dog. I'm not quite sure what that one's all about. And then the Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
The original.
Okay. So yeah, she's still around in a sense.
She's like there, but she wasn't like a consistent force. But that's, you know, showbiz is a tough biz.
Yeah, she was in American Pie 2 back in 2001, in case you didn't feel old enough already.
Oh, I will say one thing about this, which was I didn't recall like how old this movie was until like put myself like in a time and be like, oh my God, that was that long ago. And also when we talked about Keira Knightley, I had no idea. She just has always been like a person in her mid-20s since she even began her career. I had no idea she actually started as like a teen actress and then went from like Bend It Like Beckham to playing a bride in Love Actually.
That's the thing. She does have this timeless beauty and charm to her where you could put a role from here, the early to mid-2000s, alongside something from the 2010s. And honestly, it might be hard to tell between them sometimes.
And she's so good. Like, she lights up that scene. I can see why her husband's best friend was obsessed with her. She's got a glow. She's effervescent. I love Keira Knightley. Well, I haven't watched like anything else she's done in like a decade, but in theory, I like her.
You love the idea of Keira Knightley more than
exactly.
The actual reality. Yeah. So I do agree, though, that the Colin Goes to America storyline, it feels like more of a sketch than a fully well-developed plotline. And so, yeah, if we're looking to trim the fat of this movie as various characters in the movie themselves would say it, because that is a running undercurrent of the jokes here, then I think this is the first place you would look.
Yeah, and actually, now that I'm looking at my notes, I technically should say, and it does make me laugh, and this is one where I question how a family could watch this together, and that would be Jack the movie stand-in, and I really have a lot of questions about what movie they are filming.
Okay, so is this the other one that you would cut, the more controversial pick?
I didn't realize it until now, like, oh, I guess technically you could cut it because not much happens. But no, my controversial pick for who I would cut, and it's cutting a big name. It's the Colin Firth storyline.
See, I actually completely agree with you on this.
Good.
The floor is yours. Take the conch.
It's not that it's bad. It's just like, okay, it's kind of shoehorned in. It's not really like he's vaguely attached to somebody. I can't remember who he's related to in the movie. But now that it's, you know, 15, 17 years later, it is like an episode of 90 Day Fiancé where it's, you know, two people who don't speak each other's language, but there's a connection. But yeah, it's just kind of like filler and it's weird and just not much happens. And it's like a cumulative of like 5 minutes of the entire movie.
Yeah, this is actually my least favorite plotline by a decent margin, I think. So I'm glad that we're copacetic on this one.
Okay, we're good.
Where I think it is just automatically difficult to make a plotline compelling when the conceit is that one of the characters can't really communicate with the other one properly. And there are delicate ways you can do that. And if you're a skilled director and if you have, I mean, Colin Firth is a fantastic actor, obviously, but with the right cast, you can sometimes bring it to life where the nonverbal communication ends up being important, not just because it has to be, but because you have the performance to make that work. And even though that is the case here, it's still undermined by like, okay, so what do you see in her? The fact that she's pretty and she works for you and she doesn't speak English. So what's on top of that? Like, what am I missing here?
Well, she did jump after all of his writing because, of course, he writes on a typewriter and it blows into the water. She did do that. She got one piece back.
That is the relatable part of that storyline, is this very old-fashioned, fussy British guy who is so... I guess this is 2003, so cutting him some slack here, but it is so not au fait with modern technology that he's still just clattering away on this old typewriter. Outdoors, no less. I mean, I would get it if he's safely ensconced in an office somewhere, but I guess for this scene to move forward as intended, we have to suspend our disbelief for a little bit.
Did people... and I was older than you in 2003, but did people just carry typewriters to and fro? I do know that they were like typewriter suitcases, but was this a common thing that you would bring a typewriter to the waterside and just take it all in and write? I don't know.
Well, hey, if you were older than me in 2003, you're also older than me in 2020, which I believe is how that works.
That's true. But, well, I don't know. I have been frozen in time for many years.
Well, sure. Same here. But yeah, I did earn my pocket money back in 2003 because my kind of technophobic mother, who adamantly refused on kind of ideological grounds to get up to date with modern IT systems, would like pay me to type up reports for her work when she got home like on the typewriter, so that was always a lot of fun. But I don't know if professional writers had the same resistance to modern methods.
Guys, if any of you listening out there are professional writers from the early 2000s, tell us what your techniques were.
Yeah, I feel like there's a good kind of time capsule thing we could do surrounding that.
Yeah.
So with Jamie and Aurelia, who's of all the characters in the movie, I feel like her name is the easiest one to forget out of basically anyone. They hit it off, so to speak. And it's unclear if she really reciprocates his attraction to any real degree. But you would think once she gets, banished back to France, so that would be the end of it. But instead, he kind of goes to France and he stalks her, tracks her down, and much of the chagrin of her sister, who thinks that, Aurelia is getting sold off to some creepy British guy, he goes to the restaurant where she's working and confesses her love in front of everyone, which that sounds completely mortifying to me. Even if I genuinely was in love with that person, I would not want them to do that. I would fall out of love with them if I was proposed to in that way, because like, clearly they don't understand anything about me. But I guess it works on her, and they both live happily ever after. So yay them.
And she comes back with him to England. What, like, I think it's a month later in the end credits, and she speaks perfect English.
Naturally, because that's how these things work.
Yeah.
Of course, he doesn't speak a lick of Portuguese still, or French.
He learned a little. Yes. He went to the language course, which I actually did think that scene was a nice piece of time, which I'm assuming happens, that you would go to like a language center and all wear headphones and, you know, speak into the void.
Sure. All I'm saying is I'm not sure if we did a Where Are They Now in 2020, that much of that has stuck in his brain still.
No, definitely not. No, it's done. Are they even still together in 2020? I don't know. Hate to be glum, you guys. It's Christmas, but
The English are not known for learning foreign languages in the first place or doing a great job of keeping that up. So I would not have high hopes on those grounds. But yeah, I mean, this type of storyline, I think it's hard to make it work to begin with. And then also just to me, the idea of any actual romantic feeling or chemistry in it is kind of shallow. I guess the idea is if they can't communicate through traditional means, and yet also there's something dragging them together, then you know it must be strong for that to be sustained through that challenge. But you really have to be careful to make that work, and I just don't think they are. It's like, okay, Jamie falls for, and this is a theme again, is guy falls for the help or falls for someone in a subordinate position to him, just falls madly in love with his housekeeper, and then this is the one time out of 100 where that doesn't all end, it doesn't all go horribly wrong.
That's actually, now that I'm thinking of it, half of this movie is guy falls for subordinate of some sort. It's not great. It's just not my fave. And it's Colin Firth, and he's like a very talented actor, and it just feels wasted in this movie because he's just it's just a quick thing. And I know everyone's doing a quick bit, but it's just, I actually forgot about this story like between viewings one and two, and I was like, oh yeah, this one.
You have this star-studded cast. With most of them, you understand going in that, okay, this is not exploring their full talents. This isn't challenging them, forcing them to unlock their full potential here. This is just a fun, lighthearted Christmas movie. this is, I would say, the only storyline that really comes to mind where it felt like this big name, this A-list talent, was actively limited by the role that they were given.
Agreed. Totally.
Yeah. So we can safely leave that storyline and the Colin saga on the cutting room floor. That gets us down to a prompt, you know, hour 45 or something in that region.
Yep. And now that I think of it, I can think of two more I'd cut if I'm being real. If not, these are my bottom stories. I don't know. Like, well, I find that the Jack the stand-in is amusing, but I do have another one that I think I could cut. And I think this ties back to what we were saying about Aurelia and Colin Firth, because I can't remember his character's name because I just don't care. I didn't like him. And that's that. What's missing, I think, in some of these for me is that the chemistry is off between a lot of them, that we're supposed to be like super into it and there's no chemistry. And where I personally found no chemistry was Laura Linney, aka Sarah, and oh God, what is his name? I wrote it down and I can't remember. Carl. Sarah and Carl.
Yes.
There is no chemistry whatsoever, and we're supposed to be rooting for this. And then, of course, it gets really uncomfortable, so the chemistry is gone. But that's another for me that is just so out of left field.
Yeah, it's a very different type of love story, one of unrequited love, than any of the others. And it's not as if she makes some grand overture and he's taken aback and then really has to wrestle with it and then ends up rejecting her, and it's incredibly tear-jerking. It's more of a crush that kind of gets forced out into the open, and she pursues it, and it looks like it's all going to go great, and then her hopes get dashed, and then she sees Carl for who he really is, and there's a much more it doesn't have that kind of, that sense of like grand tragedy to it, where even though it all ends in heartbreak, you know, you are taken on this journey along the way. It's just a sad story, which in one sense is a nice contrast to having the movie, where it is a good reminder that love isn't always easy, despite what the Jamie and Aurelia thing might have you believe. Sometimes you shoot your shot and it doesn't work, or even worse, it kind of does work or is about to work, and then you see who the other person really is. But I don't know if it really fits the tone that Love Actually is going for.
It goes really away from everything else. And Laura Linney is such a talented actress, and I think this was before she hit like her big stride, so it's almost like she's on the cusp of when she becomes like Laura Linney, Emmy, Oscar, I can't remember what she wins, but it takes this turn too where we find out that she's actually like her brother's care keeper, and he has mental illness and he's in some sort of facility, and she goes to see him, and like he tries to like hit her like very hard, and she like grabs the hit. It's very dark, and it's about like it's that sibling love they're showing, and like unconditional sibling love, but it's definitely like tone shift, because the first hour of Love Actually is like very fun and flirt. It's kind of very like classic 90s, but it's 2003, and then it just turns.
Maybe the idea is that you only have a certain amount of like saccharine lovey-dovey stuff that you can do without it becoming way too much, even for a film like this. So it's good to counterbalance that with something which is more it doesn't have to be actively dark, but maybe more somber, more thoughtful, and makes you think about the other complexities of love. And so in that sense, I think it does succeed on that basis. And I did actually like the brother aspect of this too, where she does realize that, you know, ultimately family is what matters to her.
Yeah.
And the test in a lot of cases of whether someone is right for you is how they respond to someone who is, you know, in a position of weakness, or someone who you have to work to understand, and you have to work to accommodate into your life. And Carl wasn't even willing to go through the most basic of effort to be understanding with her and her situation there. And so, you know, this image that she had constructed of him based on just, I guess, the physical image that she has of him, just crumbled before her. And then she realized that she wasn't really missing out on anything.
True. He was boring. I mean, we all could tell that just from his bear walking by. But I think, I guess, on my end of like, that if we do have these tragedies in the movie, that it's so outweighed by the power of the Emma Thompson, Alan Rickman story, which we'll get to, that to me was like the ideal heartbreak I guess I wanted from the movie a little bit more than this weird one that has like no chemistry, no connection anyways.
Yeah, not to spoil the results of this countdown format that we seem to have fallen into here, which I do like, by the way, where we're kind of progressively eliminating the like weaker and weaker storylines until, you know, we finally get to announce the winners. But yeah, I think that I see what they're going for, but I also see why this either didn't land for some people or it worked on its own terms, but detracted from the overall vibe of the movie there. If we're leaving that one behind, what others would you, if we're slimming this movie down to a tight hour on the dot, what else are we aiming to cut here?
Well, so I guess if we're cutting it down to really get it to like that hour, we do have to cut Jack the stand-in because nothing happens. It's just a lot of like simulated sex acts while they work in a movie. And then eventually he asks her on a date and that's really it. And it's funny and weird. And it's that guy who plays Tim on The British Office. But besides that, that is really like interstitial filler where it was like that would be like we saw this if Love Actually was a play. This is the costume change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Martin Freeman does always seem to end up in these roles where he's either the sidekick who is kind of a tutting and disapproving of whatever the main guy's going along with, but doesn't have the force to talk him out of it and just ends up, you know, bumbling along with him anyway. Or he is the like secondary love interest who turns out to be the ideal guy who maybe he doesn't excite you in quite the same way, but ultimately he wins you over, wins your heart. You see the warmth inside of him, and that seems to be the archetype that he's become now, and I guess there are worse things to be, honestly.
And I always forget his name. I do love Martin Freeman, and so like just it being him and that sensibility in his acting is like the only reason that it's probably not like much lower on the list, because it's him and he's funny and it, you know, pays off when he's just like running through the airport at the end. They're like, we got engaged. It's like, okay.
With Martin Freeman more so than a lot of other performers, I wonder how much continuity there is between his real life and the types of role that he ends up being cast in. Like, you know, Alan Rickman, for example, as far as I know, maybe he's been cancelled behind my back while I wasn't looking, but as far as I know, people will say he's great at playing this imposing on-screen villain, but he's just a lovely teddy bear off-screen. It feels like with Martin Freeman, what you see kind of is what you get, and that is kind of the whole essence of his roles, right?
I think he's like that, or it's like the opposite. And if you see him in person, he's actually probably, or he's like maybe really unfriendly. It's one or the other. I don't think it's like in between. I think it's like either, it's probably he gets stopped a lot for The Hobbit, and he's probably tired of that. And people saying, I hate The Hobbit. That would be me. I didn't care for The Hobbit. So I liked Lord of the Rings, though. Just, you know.
Well, that's a whole nother podcast in and of itself for some time in the future. But yeah, I think this is another plotline which felt like it was in between a sketch and an actual plotline. And so it feels like either you cut it all together, or maybe you double down on it more and flesh it out further so that when John and Judy inevitably do just go out for a drink, a more understated final outcome than most of these others, that warms the cockles in your heart a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Again, it's better to me than Colin, because I just thought it was like too much, and I just found him like to be the most annoying human on earth, versus like at least, you know, Martin Freeman makes Jack a warm, lovable character, despite him being, you know, naked simulating sex for his cumulative 5 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, there was something very British about this scene, I thought, where this is awkwardness that both parties I understand is there, but neither of them wants to acknowledge, because that in itself would be awkward. That is a very Martin Freeman quality from a lot of the roles that you've seen him in. But also, I think this plotline does a good job of highlighting how it isn't always love at first sight. It isn't always I'm madly in love with you and will chase you across the continent, even though you literally don't speak my language and we've never communicated before. Sometimes it is, you know, you don't quite know what to say, or it's a little uneasy at first. And that doesn't mean that whatever you eventually develop between you isn't sincere or authentic. It's just it doesn't always immediately slot together.
Yeah, they're just coworkers, you know, enjoying each other's time. And there's a lot of stand-in work.
Even if their job literally is to slot together or pretend like they are.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. I thought it was also a fun contrast to have them just stark naked, in a very awkward professional capacity, and then having to pretend like none of that's going on and it's just another day at actual office.
It's at least a fun one. And now we're at the point, though, that I don't think I would cut any of the stories, even if one of them to me is very bizarre.
All right, we're down to the good stuff. And now that you've introduced it that way, we can't bury the lead there. What is the bizarre storyline left on the board for you?
We've got to go with Peter, Juliet, and the guy from The Walking Dead. I forgot to write down his character's name.
Andrew Lincoln or Mark?
Yeah. Mark. That's what it is, Mark, a.k.a. Andrew Ridgely. So Peter and Mark are best friends, and Peter is marrying Juliet. And, you know, it's a wonderful wedding day. It has what appears to be one of the earliest kind of flash mobs that I can know on record. And then we find out that the wedding videographer sucks and Mark has recorded everything, except Mark's video recordings are not very helpful because it's just creeping cam on Juliet because he's secretly in love with his best friend's wife.
And I do love how committed his videography is to just creepily capturing Juliet, where you would think that Peter would accidentally enter the shot at some point somewhere in here, but no, it's just all Juliet all the time.
Was he planning to watch this again, or did he just happen to film it and it's just like, okay, I did this, you know, like how like people record concerts and it's like you're never gonna watch it again?
Yeah, I guess it's not like you record a concert so that you can post it on Instagram as evidence that you were there at the concert. Like, that would be a little bit weird to do in this context. But yeah, I dread to think what kind of private uses this footage was earmarked for.
It's a weird story. And we never get this, obviously, and like life goes on. But like, do you think in the future that there's ever a point where Peter and Juliet ever discuss this and it becomes a problem? Do you think him and Mark remain friends? Because it's basically like, Andrew Lincoln, Mark, professes his love to Juliet in this iconic scene that everyone loves where he holds the cards up so that he can secretly tell her he's in love with her while her husband is upstairs, which people view as romantic and I view as a little creepy. I'm a woman. I would say this violates bro code, correct? Is this not a violation of bro code?
Definitely both anti-bro code and creepy at the same time. But yeah, this feels like Juliet just nods politely and, you know, does what she has to do to usher him away. And then they never speak of it ever again.
No, they all go to the airport together at the end. And it's like this weird elephant in the room. And I'm like, they've obviously not discussed this. It's just bizarre.
Looked at through a more modern lens, you think is he like somehow a third party in their actual relationship now, or like has this taken on a whole new life of its own, or what exactly is going on here?
Sequel.
Yeah, I don't know how uplifting Love Actually 2 would be if we saw a lot of these characters again in any kind of realistic timeline.
No, I did think while watching the movie, though, there was obviously, and we'll a teaser, we'll get there, that I feel like there is one story that could be the jumping off point for if you ever did a sequel. But I'm really tired of sequels, so I don't want it just for that reason. But I feel like this could be, you know, and I'm actually shocked it hasn't happened by this point because this movie has such a huge cult following.
Yeah, I think there was some like a Christmas short that they did, some mini reunion of the cast, which I didn't hear much about it at the time. I don't know many of the details, but I guess trying to just get the last drop of milk out of whatever clout they can from that 10 years on.
Yeah, this is like, I bet for them at least it's like a fat residual check every Christmas or every like January 1st, and everyone's so excited to be in this movie.
Yeah, even like Martin McCutcheon or whoever, I'm sure is making bank after all these years from that stint on Love Actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, to me, this storyline, I had kind of the similar issues with it that I had with the Jamie and Aurelia thing, where you have this guy who is, he has this love inside of him just trying to burst out of his chest. You know, he can't possibly contain himself. But this doesn't seem to be based on any real interaction between him and this object of his desire. She just exists as this kind of a ideal canvas for him to project things onto. Like we learn that there's some awkwardness between Juliet and Mark, because she thinks that he dislikes her because he's very reluctant to talk with her or spend much time around her, doesn't seem to know all that much about her as a person. And so, you know, if that's your husband-to-be's best man at your wedding, then obviously you kind of are confused by that. You want to smooth things over, make sure that things are okay. And that's how we get to this big reveal in the first place. And so it's not like they were the best of friends before that. And then, you know, he's been nursing this crush and he worries that voicing that is going to fundamentally change or damage their friendship. He's just there in, you know, she's there in his life and he just happens to have latched himself onto her, but would never dream of actually saying anything about it until, you know, the cat is out of the bag, because obviously he's in this awkward situation. And you can somewhat empathize with that. But at the same time, it's, you know, the way he goes about it is just, I don't find it romantic really at all.
No, and it's like, it is like the iconic scene of the movie. It's the one that's memed the most, like positively or negatively. Well, not negatively, either positively, like romantically or like sarcastically. It's what everyone thinks of for the movie. But for me, this was definitely, I think, the first time around, because I didn't know the context of the movie and I just knew that scene. I was like, oh.
Yeah, it's... Oh, to me, you're perfect. Okay, well, tell me three things about yourself. You know, like,
yeah, like you haven't spoken to me. Some character
traits that I have. Yeah.
Also, I can't remember exactly. I remember that there was, when the wedding starts, was he the one who got prostitutes for the bachelor party, but accidentally got male prostitutes?
Yes. And speaking of possible homoerotic undertones, yeah, or overtones, I'm not sure which way that goes. There was some fan theory I know that Mark initially was like in love with Peter, and then he couldn't admit that to himself. But it was clear there was some aspect of unrequited love there. And so that became like misdirected onto Juliet instead, because that was a more, I guess, in the early 2000s, it certainly would have been, that was a more socially acceptable thing to channel that towards.
And actually, it's mentioned in the movie, Sarah, aka Laura Linney, is at the wedding, because, you know, everybody has to overlap in their Modern Family way before Modern Family was a thing. But she asks him if he's like in love with him, and he's like, oh, no, because, you know, Mark again is camcorder recording the whole wedding, which, because I'd forgotten like what the origin of the story was, I did put my notes in all caps, camcorder !! Because it felt like just such a timestamp, because there was a time that if we did go out to bars that we would hold like full size cameras with us, or like, you know, the initial pocket digital camera. So it was a real throwback to some fonder times in life.
And there are some more layers to that question too, where I think Mark could answer yes to that question, because he does have a platonic love for his best friend, but as a certain type of British guy, he would never admit to something like that in those terms. But maybe there is a natural catch here, which is he is romantically in love with Peter as well, but couldn't admit that either. But whatever interpretation you put on this storyline, I just don't really find its conclusion romantic. And that can be okay insofar as, you know, the Sarah and Carl thing, right? That doesn't have a romantic conclusion, but it does have a
fitting conclusion.
It's a fitting conclusion to a story about romance, right? It's believable on its own terms, like its internal logic. Whereas this one, it's just Mark doesn't ever want to communicate with Peter or with Juliet, and so he just lets this simmer until it boils over, and then he busts out the cue cards and the boombox, and that's where we get the big reveal.
And still hangs out with them afterwards. Like, you would think that maybe after that you start to distance yourself, like, you know what, it's like, maybe I need to, but nope, still it's a trio. Maybe he started to speak to Juliet finally, but yeah, again, like you said, projecting all these feelings onto somebody that he's barely spoken to, barely connected with, who knows, it's, yeah. But, you know, an early Chiwetel Ejiofor before he became big and famous. So pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think it does make sense to try to work a story of unrequited love into this medley. You know, if you're telling all these stories about romance, it is only right for one of them to be focused around that. But I'm not sure this one really hit that right note for me.
Yeah, no.
And that doesn't leave us with all that many, actually. We're making very good time here. So, let's I guess save one of the best for last. Let's talk about the PM himself, Hugh Grant.
I love this one.
A Justin Trudeau before his time, a kind of a Tony Blair, Bill Clinton mashup imitation act. And Hugh Grant really is in full force. This is him leaning into his character.
I love Hugh Grant. I know he had his 90s scandals, but I've always been a Hugh Grant fan. As we know, I've still been living in anger that he did not get nominated for an Oscar for Paddington 2. And his performance in Love Actually is not as equal as that one, but still phenomenal. I love him.
Yeah, he wouldn't be a dashing young bachelor politician if he didn't have some skeletons in his closet from the mid-90s.
Exactly.
Yeah, so very true to his role, method acting, I suppose you could credit him with in that sense. And he's going to fall for Natalie, played by a younger Martin McCutcheon, a very junior member of his internal staff at 10 Downing Street. And this develops kind of uneasily over time, where initially they catch each other's eyes from across the room and she smiles at him, but which of course she does because she works for him and is, you know, he is 10 rungs her senior. But it feels like there is some kind of chemistry, and it is very like adorable or awkward to see the most powerful man in the country by some standards just like be tongue-tied around this very junior employee, because you know he's smitten, he's got this little boy crush on her.
Yeah, and she like stumbles when they first introduce like three of the employees to him, and she stumbles and she said like, oh, I thought I'd say like the F word in front of you, and he's like, oh, haha, and then she does. Like, they do, unlike most of these stories as I've complained, they do have like a natural chemistry. It makes sense. And I'd like to think that what's happening off screen is he's seeing what a talented and amazing worker, and he's falling in love with her work ethic and her personality, and not just this silent mute that is doing like dutiful work for him. I'd like to think he saw more to her.
Yeah, and it's hard not to have a certain level of chemistry with Hugh Grant. Like, if you don't, then something has gone terribly wrong. Even if you're a guy, I would say, or maybe especially if you're a guy.
Everybody has chemistry with Hugh Grant.
But and these two generally do seem to like it is believable, and as you say, they have a certain comedic timing as well, this like back and forth with each other, this good like comic patter, and yeah, it's there is a depth to that chemistry that there really isn't with, you know, to go back to my my bete noire here, the just like mute French housekeeper who, you know, he couldn't tell you a first thing about her, in part because he doesn't speak a lick of French, and so what, or Portuguese, and what's he meant to do about that? Whereas this time around, you can see how something like this could lead to the Prime Minister making a very bad decision and being on the front page of every newspaper.
Exactly. I mean, I watch The Crown. It happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. And this is in the early 2000s, where the memory of like the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky thing,
yes, was
still very much in people's memories. And if there is a timeliness to Love Actually, yeah, leaving aside the weird 9/11 scheduling that we've had to wrestle around here, then it is that you know, you have Hugh Grant directly challenging the American president in a way that, you know, Tony Blair wasn't to George Bush back then, but then also Hugh Grant as PM adding with a certain level of decorum that Bill Clinton did not, let's say, in his White House dealings.
It was very, oh, I love when he puts President Billy Bob Thornton in his place, because I wrote Billy Bob Thornton looks like a creep. He was very young. I mean, obviously it was 2003. And also I'd never noticed Billy Bob Thornton's very bright white chompers before. He had very big teeth.
That's the American teeth whitening that you get if you're going to be a public figure.
Yeah, usually I would say chompers about like a British reality contestant's veneers, but Billy Bob's chompers were on full display in this movie. And I wrote in my notes, this is a direct quote, surprise, he's a creep.
Whereas, of course, the British are not going to have anything approaching that level of dentistry going on. But as you say, the POTUS looks like a creep and turns out is a creep, because Hugh Grant walks in on him trying to grope Natalie and have his way with her. And I didn't actually like this twist to that storyline. I feel like you can have Natalie acquire the sense of shame and confusion and introduce a tension into her relationship with the PM without needing to have the actual most powerful person in the world just kind of like fly in as this comic book villain to steal her away from the PM. And I don't think you need that in order to set up Hugh Grant goes off on the American president and we all feel good about ourselves in the movie and also in real life, because we kind of wish that our prime minister would do that as well.
Truly, it felt like if this happened current day, it would really hit home nicely. Mm-hmm. And also, like, we already got a sense that he was a creep when he first walked in and Natalie walked by and he gave like a creepy comment. So, like, I just don't think it had to go as far. I mean, I see why they did it, so that really, really pushes him over the edge. But it was clear, like, he's a creep. His policy stuff he's doing was just to sabotage them and make them, you know, make them derailed. So I feel like it already gave us the reasons why, you know, Hugh Grant would like make this man a mockery of the world. So, yeah.
And I think that would make Hugh Grant a more sympathetic figure in that role, too. If he sees the president just being an asshole towards some junior member of staff, and that by itself is enough to motivate him to slap back at him in public, versus he's literally trying to stick his tongue down her throat. And
yeah,
that by itself, you know, because he's the other guy that, you know, he's jealous or whatever.
Yeah, because then, like, this poor character has to be violated. And not only that, I should talk about another thing. The one thing about this story that really gets under my skin, and that is the fat shaming of Natalie, who is so thin and beautiful that it is disgusting. Even her own family calls her fat. And it's like, she's not, or they call her chubby. And I hate that part of the story. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, and this comes back to, I think, discussion about how realistic those kind of dynamics need to be, because honestly, it is sadly true to life that often someone, even someone who looks and carries herself like Natalie here, is going to be fat shamed like that. That said, do you need to include it in the movie and have that be an internal reminder to people who go through that's the case, just for the sake of building the drama? And also because Natalie's family is presented as, you know, supportive and loving for the most part, and so the fact that they're just very casually undermining her like that really rubs against that and rubs you as the viewer the wrong way. That certainly is worth kind of pausing and looking at in a more modern context. But also, it's, you don't know whether to directly push back against it and say, well, no, just look at Natalie, that obviously is not the case, or to say, well, even if that were true, like, who cares? That's not the question we should be talking about in the first place.
Exactly. Or is this like a casting thing that was supposed to be that the prime minister falls for someone like totally different than you would expect in his cabinet, and then they cast her? I don't know, but I just still, like, when they call her chubby and plumpy, it gets under my nerves, because I'm like, she's such a normal human.
It may also be the case that everyone's attractiveness gets scaled up the way that you would expect from a feel-good Hollywood blockbuster, right? And so, yeah, maybe Natalie is, you know, plain or homely by the standards of a cast that includes, you know, Hugh Grant and Keira Knightley and so on and so forth. But whose standards are you really going by then?
Right. In my mind, I feel like she's like, if we're saying like who's the most attractive people in the movie, she's probably two or three.
Right, and those power rankings by themselves feel like it's you kind of feel uncomfortable even trying to draw that up. But
exactly.
The other aspect too is Hugh Grant catches Natalie, in flagrante with POTUS, and decides to just have her reassigned to a different department instead of ever talking to her about it or getting HR involved or communicating the problem. It's just he dials up another one of his secretaries and is like, all right, let's just ship Natalie off to the Foreign Office or something and, you know, get her out of sight and out of mind.
There's a lot of secretaries in this movie. Like, everybody is, every man falls for a secretary. The more we're talking, the more I'm pulling back on my stance of like, oh, I'm fine with this movie. And I'm like, oh, because I did yesterday notice, you know, I'm like, is this like every man sleeps with a secretary, the movie?
I mean, if you want a realistic depiction of,
apparently this is life. Everybody sleeps with their secretary.
Oh, well, that's the thing about Love Actually. And I would say many Christmas movies or Christmas rom-coms, is they're funny until you step back and examine them too seriously. And yeah, if you want to enjoy them, right. I mean, in that sense, podcasting about it may be a self-defeating idea from the outset, right? Maybe we're just meant to sit back and just marinate in the general vibe and ambience of the movie and leave it at that.
For what I'll say, though, is that this is like one of my favorite storylines, and I could watch a full movie about this if you just take out calling this woman chubby all the time.
Yeah, the David and Natalie thing does work for me, even despite all of these things that we've listed here.
It's kind of like the movie The American President, which I don't think I actually sat through all of because I was a wee child. But, you know, it's like a classic story.
Mm-hmm. So let's go on to a storyline which I think we've mentioned in passing, if in a fairly grim context here, and that is a tale of young love here, where Liam Neeson's character, Daniel, his wife has just passed away. He has to raise his, not just his son, but his stepson alone. And his stepson, Sam, is in love. He's got his first crush on an American classmate, Joanna, who is going back to the States. And this is his final chance to win her over and confess his true feelings. And we see him dashing through the airport so that he can do that. I know that you've said that this is actually, for you, maybe the saddest scene in the entire movie.
Yeah, so my take on this is actually, it's like a really dark story. And the reason why is actually in the movie, it is like a cute story. It's one of my favorites. I think it's well acted. I love the, they have great chemistry together as a father and stepson. So in 2003, Liam Neeson was married. And then a few years later, I forget how long it was, Liam Neeson's wife, who was an actress, passed away in a skiing accident. So to me, this story like mirrors what I would imagine his life to be, of like that he becomes this character. And so when I watch it, I get a little sad and I think of it that way.
Yeah. And it's almost like you wish you could unlearn that and not know the context so that you could just enjoy this subplot for what it is.
It's such a good plot. I mean, it's somewhat, it's funny. It's that they had this really great chemistry and she always wanted him, like, she said, like, you can bring Claudia Schiffer to the funeral, which becomes this running thing that eventually leads to Claudia Schiffer playing his new girlfriend. And it's a really great story. But yeah, I just happen to think of this weird connection to Liam Neeson's real life, which is unfortunate for me, but it's a wonderful story.
Hey, shoot your shot. If you want to manifest a relationship with Claudia Schiffer, this is how you do it.
Exactly. Don't tell Jerry Gergich from Parks and Rec. He would be very... Was his Elle McPherson? Who was his? His is Elle McPherson. Supermodels in the 90s.
Either way, I don't think Jerry Gergich is going to be much competition for you, especially if you're Liam Neeson. So I think in the clear on that one. But yeah, it's... that real-life parallel exists elsewhere in the movie too, where Emma Thompson is able to turn in such a compelling performance as Karen because she went through the same thing herself in real life with Kenneth Branagh, right? And so, you know, Emma Thompson is going to be good in whatever you put her in, but there's certainly a realism to her performance that shines through, and that's not a realism you ever want to deliver that role with, but sadly she is in that position too.
Oh, what another heartbreaking story. On the Liam Neeson front too, I don't remember how old Sam is supposed to be, but he keeps thinking the kid's on heroin.
Yeah, it's look, I know that there are some rough parts of the UK or whatever, but certainly not the one that any of the characters in this movie would ever live in.
That seems like a real jump for what I would say would at most as a 13-year-old is like he's on heroin.
And yeah, I don't know if there's even in those bad parts, I don't know if preteen kids are hitting the good stuff like that.
No, that seems like a real deep cut. That means he's probably experimented real deep. And I love the idea that he thought like he was moping around and the kid was like, because of like the mom, and he's like, no, like I miss mom, but like I'm moping because I'm in love.
I guess it might make more sense if Liam Neeson's character was some like high-flying finance guy and all of them have been, you know, shooting up coke in the work bathroom since the 80s or whatever. And yeah, he's raised his kid in that image, but that isn't the vibe I get from that character at all.
They also love the movie Titanic. I thought that scene was really cute where they reenact Titanic.
Yes. But so you said that you thought Sam was like in the like 12 to 13 kind of range. I always viewed him as much younger, but I'm not sure where I got that from.
I'm being generous because when I did my Googling, I found out that the actor was like very close in age to Keira Knightley, that only a few years. So I assumed like Sam was probably like 10, if not like honestly like 8, but maybe the kid just like the actor happened to look young. So that's why I'm now thinking that maybe he was a tween, but he definitely seems like a jealous little baby boy. Because when he gets mad at the concert, because she says, Joanna sings All I Want for Christmas Is You, and she points at him, and it's like his heart soars. And then she points at other people, and he looks like he's going to murder everybody in that crowd.
It is so well done. Yeah, he maybe falls into that gray zone where he's not a child actor anymore, but he's not really a fully fledged adult either.
You know what I like too is that for learning it for what, like 2 to 3 weeks, not bad at the drums.
No, this is a crash course. This is a last minute cramming for an exam that you didn't even know you had to take.
No, he decides that, you know, in order to win the girl, he should join the band so he can be part of this multi-school Christmas pageant and, you know, practices away. And they keep talking about Ringo a lot. I thought Ringo was going to pop up in the movie, by the way. Like, at the rate they were saying it, I was like, he's got to show up.
I don't know what the official Beatles power rankings were for young women in their day, but I don't know if the drummer is usually deemed to be the most attractive member of the band. I think it's usually the lead guitarist, and then if they're taking you, work your way back to the bass guitarist, and then you maybe talk about the drummer.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a Beatles super fan. I can ask my friends who are, but I don't know if it's Ringo is 3 or 4 or George. Not, yeah, is it George? George is 3 or 4.
I couldn't tell you, but I should. And I'm a bad Brit for not being able to help
it's
out.
It's fine. That. It's okay.
I think that only really leaves, I would say, the best storyline and also, but maybe because it is also one of the saddest storylines of the movie. And this is a truly fantastic performance by not just Alan Rickman, but also Emma Thompson here.
Where, oh, she's so good. She's good in everything, but this is just, levels.
So Harry, aka Alan Rickman, is the director of this design agency, and he also has a young, nubile new secretary, and his wife, who at the start of the movie he seems pretty happily married to. There's this rift that grows over time where Mia is not being at all subtle about her wish.
No!
Oh my god! You can see her sticking her tendrils into him. And then eventually at the Christmas party for their company, you see them chatting again and they're dancing. And then this leads to, you know, one thing leads to another. He ends up going to the jewelry store staffed by Mr. Bean himself.
Oh my God. What, I forgot about that. And I was so delighted. That scene, please tell me he improv the whole thing because it's just so good.
I wonder if I don't know the Rowan Atkinson filmography as much as I should, but is he also typecast in roles like this where he is only ever the Mr. Bean of that cinematic universe?
I am not either. I feel like this maybe we might have just made our New Year's resolution together to really get into the Rowan Atkinson filmography. But I have to imagine he always plays this bumbling Mr. Bean character.
I know he was in a similar role in Four Weddings and a Funeral, which is that was my dad's favorite movie. I think he watched that more than any other show or film in his life. And just because of that, I passively absorbed the general vibe of that movie, even if I couldn't tell you anything about it.
It's one on my list to see of like movies I should have seen but haven't. But you know who is in that movie? Hugh Grant.
Of course. The similarities never end.
I'm looking now at Mr. Bean's filmography.
Johnny English, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, hey, he knows his lane and he sticks to it. And I got to have respect for that.
I used to, this is like a weird thing. When I was in junior high, I went to go see the Mr. Bean movie a couple times so I could sneak into R-rated movies.
That is a very Mr. Bean technique as well. You really.
Really? Yeah, truly.
You're really honoring the character there. But yeah. But Rowan Atkinson in fine form as always, but he's not the point here. So
we digress. This is not going to be a Mr. Bean podcast anymore, even though we would like to be.
So Harry ends up procuring this necklace for me.
An ugly necklace, by the way. A very ugly necklace.
Yeah, you could make an argument that Emma Thompson's character sees the necklace, does think it's for her, and just is sad that her husband's taste is so poor. But
yeah.
She finds this necklace, assumes it's for her, and then when she unwraps the Joni Mitchell CD, of all things, she then learns that there's another woman in his life.
And I, because I, for again, since it's my second time viewing, I forgot. And I wrote in my notes, like, he put the cheater present under the tree, which wouldn't surprise me that he would be that dumb, like, just a stupid thing to do. But it was a Joni Mitchell CD as a throwback. And when she opens that gift, the heartbreak you can feel of, like, what a terrible gift this is. And it gave me a reminder of, I saw an Am I the Asshole post that was trending on Twitter of a guy who, like, never bought his wife gifts. And so his kids, like, went and bought a gift for him. And it like made me think of that, of just, like, giving terrible gifts or no gift at all. And that, honestly, getting your wife a CD, which I know CDs in 2003 were more money, especially for a double disc kind of packaging, but what an awful gift.
Now, does the fact that it's a Joni Mitchell CD cushion the blow at all, or does it make it even worse?
I feel like that's even worse.
It's hard to get yourself in the minds of a couple of that age to see what their taste would be, but yeah, I'm not sure that if I had just had my entire world swept out from underneath me, that a Joni Mitchell CD is the consolation prize I would want to take home with me.
She did use it right away, though. She went into the room, put it on, and cried, and then composed herself to go to the pageant.
And that scene is so incredible. And this is the weird dichotomy of Love Actually, where you can have these very over-the-top, very hammy plot lines alongside this incredibly raw and sincere performance in this one kind of siloed off other plot line. And this by itself, this could be extended to a movie. Like, why watch a Marriage Story, right, when you could just watch Emma Thompson in this 15 or 20 minutes combined that they have over the course of the movie?
Exactly. It is a beautiful story, and maybe the fact that it is like a short tale really is why it resonates so well and hits harder than the others, because you don't see everything, where it's kind of, like, she sees them at the party, Harry and Mia. Is Mia the assistant's name?
Yeah.
I kept thinking they said, like, multiple names. But anyways, who, by the way, wore devil horns to a Christmas party.
Yes.
But she just was like, oh, okay, like, you know, coworker banter. Like, it's polite to, I guess it's polite to slow dance with people, whatever. But, like, it wasn't like this whole movie of her, like, missing things. It's just like, okay, life goes on or whatever. And not like she doesn't look dumb in this moment. It just looks like, oh, we're all enjoying a party. You know, they seem to have a good banter at home and things seem to be okay. And it just seems like this is catching them in, like, a moment. Not that this has been this long time sort of thing, just that he's wavering and she never realized that that could happen.
Right. It's not as if their relationship is shown as being unhappy and dysfunctional from the outset. It's more that they have a good thing going on, and yet whether it's a moment of weakness or an underlying weakness that is just now shining through in that moment when some shiny new temptation comes along, you see her husband straying. And that's what kind of makes it so brutal, is it seems like he has a happy enough, good enough life, and he's willing to just throw it all away in search of some momentary new thrill. And you get that devastating quote from Emma Thompson where Harry says, I'm a classic fool, and she replies, yeah, but you've also made a fool out of me. You've made the life I lead foolish too. And that's that drives home the just sense of complete betrayal and disappointment so perfectly.
And the thing about it too is that you see them a lot and they, like, obviously have their dialogue, but their acting is so much more than the words. And that's why this stands out, because it's two top tier A-list, like, best of the best, taking the moment that they have of, like, a short amount of a film and giving it their all.
Mm-hmm. And even though I think the consensus would be this is the best plot line out of the nine that made the final cut, there is still room for some debate here, because when we get that reunion montage all at the end at the airport, there's still some debate over whether she is still with him in that final scene or exactly what their dynamic is. So what was your read on that?
So I took it as that I think he had to go travel, which I don't remember if they set that up or not, but he was coming back. And I think it's like they had a break, but now they're coming back together. And maybe you would think, like, that break was going to help, but it was actually the time to, like, for her to think on it. And she's just still not happy that that one action he took was like damning for everything, and now she's kind of stuck with him for now at least, and going to an unhappy home.
Yeah, to me it did feel like they were still together for the sake of the kids. You know, they've fallen into that pattern where she had clearly not gotten over their betrayal, but was very practiced at putting a brave face on things and was able to grit her teeth, and so, you know, the kids wouldn't ask too many questions, and when they're out in public they can play the role of a happy couple still, and there's still some affection there for him, some love, but it's I don't think she's ever going to be able to fully get over that betrayal.
Yeah, it was that happy marriage and life they had where she still seemed like fully in love with him disappeared in that moment when she got that Joni Mitchell CD.
And what did you make of that final montage as a whole, where we travel around all these loose ends, tying them up, and we bring everything to this neat conclusion? Did that final scene work for you? Did you leave the movie on a high note there?
I did. You know what? It was nice to get like some loose ends tied for the characters, even though I did have to rewind because I missed where it said like 1 month later. Because I was wondering, given that some relationships progress very far, and some of them it's like weird, like why weren't you back sooner?
Yeah, so I mean, Colin is basically married already.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, aren't there visa processes you have to go through? Again, I watched 90 Day Fiancé. I don't know if it's that easy. I mean, I guess maybe because it's UK, but what really hit me, and this is, I think, a very like 2020 feeling, is watching all these other loved ones of real life people that they filmed that day, or extras. I don't really know how they implemented it, but that stuff really hit, to just see the happiness between real people being reunited at the airport and hugging and crowds and that kind of thing. Like, that really hit in 2020.
My understanding was that was genuine footage, and then they had to go through the usual process of getting consent for that to be included in the film. And to me, that is a testament that kind of authentic, not unedited, because, you know, clearly this is part of a kind of scripted ending scene, but just you don't need to overlay anything onto that. There doesn't need to be any kind of a commentary or dialogue or music or anything, but just seeing that footage by itself inspires emotions that even the most carefully crafted script is not going to hit all the time. And so the fact that they were able to tie that in and kind of bookend the movie with the fictional PM quote at the beginning and then that real footage at the end, that really tied the room together nicely for me.
Yeah, and they had that Beach Boys song God Only Knows, and it's like, it's just such a good song anyways, and you've got this collage and montage people, like, to tie it back to the song that Billy covered, you know, Love Is All Around Us.
Mm-hmm. So as an American, I don't know if stuff like the Ant and Dec cameo, or I don't know if there are British Easter eggs that just fly over the head of a non-British audience.
I think so, because I have no idea what reference that one was.
Okay, then. So that clears that one up. But the Brits listening know what I'm talking about. I think that was that was very fun to see. But what other thoughts did you have watching this movie for the second time very recently?
Well, we didn't talk about, I think we missed a little bit about the pageant. The Christmas pageant, of course, is the culmination of everything. It's a delightful scene. There is a Christmas lobster, a Christmas octopus. It's a real wonderful pageant, and also leads to the Prime Minister and Natalie sneaking behind the stage to be able to watch the show, but also sneak a kiss, and then being exposed in front of everybody, and it's going to be like front page news. I love that scene.
Yeah, that was so nice. And whenever you have the scene at the end that brings together all of the cast members, you really want the whole ensemble to be firing on all cylinders, and it felt like they definitely did in that scene, even though some of them were less prominent maybe than they had been in the past, and just, you know, for time concerns, automatically not everyone was going to get to be the shining star there.
No, only Joanna really was the shining star there. That kid could sing.
Yeah, but do we know what became of that actress?
I feel like I remember reading something once years ago, and now I don't remember. I'm going to look it up. Hold on, I'm Googling this. But she was so good. And also, of course, to fit All I Want for Christmas Is You, which is, you know, a modern Christmas classic. Because we don't, as I said, there's a lot of Christmas trash music out there. But Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas is, you know, is iconic.
And the trashier the better in my books. But this was genuinely a good rendition of a good song. So I have to applaud her on that front.
Yeah, just like, I would love to know Mariah Carey's opinion, which I think she'd probably approve. I know that there was a thing about Mariah Carey didn't like the unofficial ornament circling around about her.
Well, sure. But I feel like if you publicly come out against Love Actually, you're kind of outing yourself as a Scrooge.
This is true. And as we, when you asked me to do this, I was very nervous, as we know, because the first time I saw it, I just thought, I don't know if it lived up to the hype, given that everybody treats it the way it was. But watching it a second time, I actually do genuinely like it better, despite that I did nix half the stories out of the script.
Yeah, you are a ruthless editor here, Mel. Like, if they ever need to slim this movie down, they know who to call.
Listen, I was that kid in school that I would red pen your paper to death if I got the chance, just cause.
So in those things where you had to like swap sheets with another kid or something and mm-hmm. then mark their work, you were just completely ruthless.
Yes, I was brutal to the girl the one time who spelled the main character's name wrong the whole paper. I'm sorry that I did mark it in every single instance, but also it gave me a lot of joy.
Well, honestly, that's on her. She's never going to make that mistake again.
Yeah. I cannot Google this for the life of me, I guess, because I'm talking at the same time. But I'm sure I did see something in one of the articles I read that she did get offered like a record deal afterwards.
Okay.
I don't know if she took it. She probably was on like, she probably did like an American Idol or something, maybe, if she didn't do that much.
So I'm looking here. She was on the Celebrity X Factor in 2019, which is interesting given that, from what I can tell, her workload between 2003 and the late 2010s was pretty barren.
Oh, so kind of like the other kid too. Well, we have to Google him. Actually, I remember hearing about that celebrity X Factor UK, because a bunch of Love Island people are on it, so I paid attention.
It's like Celebrity Big Brother in that no actual celebrities are going to take time out of their schedule to do this. But people who are trying to get another 15 minutes of fame, you know, they're dime a dozen.
I wonder if she won.
I don't know, actually. But yeah, I'm sure the Love Actually soundtrack itself was maybe a hit on the Christmas charts back in 2003. I'm not quite sure.
Truly. It also had, I wrote at one point under for when Mark is outed for being in love with Juliet, and he like runs out of his apartment, his studio, and Dido just blares, and he like has like a rage moment and almost hits an extra, which I'd like to think that extra was just like someone was like, go walk by, and he had no idea that like he was gonna like go like, ah, because he jumps so high.
And given that this is Love Actually, that extra probably is a celebrity in their own right, who is now like a multi-millionaire Emmy winner or something.
Yeah, watch it. It's like, that was George Clooney.
Well, sure, he looks a little different, but hey, that's the wonders of makeup.
I now know who you meant for the cameo. Is that the guys who hosted Popstar UK or X Factor originally way back?
Honestly, Mel, you know so much more about musical competition shows, even in my own country, than I do. It makes me feel very self-conscious about myself.
I did dabble a bit in X Factor UK, and I stopped watching Idol because I was like so tired of it, and I hate The Voice because it's not about the contestants, but I love X Factor. I fell off of it, but I love X Factor UK for the spectacle of it.
Is this a global phenomenon? So are you all up to date with, like, I don't know, X Factor Bulgaria or something? Or is this only a transatlantic special relationship kind of deal?
Just transatlantic. It was on some very random channel here, and so I got very into it for a couple of seasons. I even got swag sent to me for, like, I have like an X Factor hat and t-shirt and I think a pint glass somewhere, but then I stopped watching it.
Definitely as a kid growing up in the early 2000s, that whole genre of like X Factor, pop stars, Britain's Got Talent, and then later on, I guess, The Voice worked its way in there towards the end. That whole genre was really a formative viewing experience for kids of my generation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where I probably learned about a lot of music and then just found out, like, oh, these aren't covers. These are actual other people. Or these are covers. Like, these are genuinely good songs by other people besides, like, the pop star sugary version of X Factor or American Idol. Yeah, those guys did look familiar, though. I just don't know what show they hosted, but they were the ones that Billy interviewed. And then he didn't he draw like penis or something on the board of the boy band Blue. He hated Blue.
I don't know if he's speaking for the audience there with that one. But yeah, I don't know if I'm the ant or the deck or which one Colin is in that relationship. But I like to think we have a certain kind of double act there, too.
I'm going to have to study because I don't think I've actually seen them hosting shows. I think I know of them, but I don't think I got to watch like their heyday. But I remember them being the template for why American Idol started with two and then they cut one because it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, they do have a completely symbiotic relationship, but you literally never see one of them on screen without the other.
And they definitely had that very early 2000s like hair suit. Like there's some of the stuff that really holds up that I think that visually you wouldn't necessarily know it was 2003. And then there's just moments that take you and you go like, oh yeah, like this, it's been a while.
There are whole essays, think pieces, books to be written about the style evolution of Ant and Dec over the course of their long and storied careers. Or I guess career collective singular.
Yes, and I did have a feedback, which was a lot of times in the movie in general, everyone seemed very underdressed. Now, I am a person who dresses very casual, especially in 2020 when I have not worn a pair of jeans since February. But like, I felt like everyone kind of seemed like not dressed for the occasion.
But they're all attractive enough and charming enough that they can get away with it, I think, is the crucial thing there.
Yeah, I guess, like, the wedding was semi-casual, but it was, like, very, very casual.
Mm-hmm. So with all of that in mind, any final thoughts here as we wrap this up?
What I'd like to say is thank you for making me rewatch this movie and giving it another chance, because I probably never would have watched it again and maintained in my mind that I was like, it's not that great. I enjoy it a lot more than I thought. So to that, I say thank you for having me on.
Well, no problem. I hope that as I said, the way to enjoy Christmas movies is to turn your brain off and not think about them. So I really hope that, as always, we have not inspired any deep thought in the audience this time around. I did my bit to try and make sure that's the case, but hope you enjoy this for what it was anyway. And who knows, maybe we'll be back in here for more Christmas movies either this year, next year, or just sometime in between. You know, there's no shame talking about Die Hard in the middle of April, right?
No, I mean, some say it's a Christmas movie and some say it is just an action movie. And honestly, that means you can drop it any time in the year.
And those people are wrong, you understand, but we have to acknowledge their existence and throw a bone to them at some point. So yeah, who knows? Maybe we'll put that on the docket for, you know, September or something.
I'm in. I'm just saying, now that I've seen it and I've now officially seen it for the first time, so now I can speak on it.
Well, I will have to watch it first, but when I get around to doing that, I'll hit you up and we can do that again. But in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at DomHRV. You can find Mel on Twitter at MelGotServed. And we wish you all a very happy Christmas, a happy new year, a tip-top holiday season, and we'll be back with you in 2021 with more fluffy nonsense like this. Take care, everyone. Come true.